Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Friday, September 17th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Noelle Swan, reading for Linda Feldman.
And I'm Ken Kaplan.
Susan Cody has long been an educator. On September 11, 2001, she was Linda's daughter's fourth grade teacher at John Eaton Elementary School in Washington, D.C. Today, she helps run a nonprofit for Burmese teachers of English in Myanmar. The pandemic halted in-person training, and then the military coup in February suspended the program altogether. This past week, Gift of Education started a new program teaching children who are unable to attend government schools. And students are eager to walk 35 minutes each way from a teak logging camp in the mountains to a village with internet access. Ms. Cody's professional evolution didn't happen in a vacuum. In 2012, her Marine son, Niall Cody Sears, was killed by an IED in Afghanistan. Ever since, this Gold Star mom has devoted herself to honoring the life of her only child in ways he would find meaningful. Niall was a musician interested in Buddhism, and Ms. Cody channeled her energy toward funding an instrumental program at a music school in Yangon, Myanmar. Then she pivoted toward the training of English teachers and joined forces with Sunda Kin, founder of Gift of Education. Ms. Cody says, "We believe it will elevate the economic and social growth of Myanmar. Everybody wants to learn English." And how has she processed the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan? She writes in an email, "Even though the Taliban have taken over again, inevitable, I am glad we are out of there. Niall felt he was doing something good there, and that means a lot to me. I won't go down the died-for-nothing road." She says, "I have to do something to keep moving forward and remembering Niall in a positive way. It nourishes me and hopefully the world." Now, today's stories. Our first story. How well and how long the Taliban will tolerate independent journalism will be telling. Many Afghan reporters fled amid threats, but others stayed, boldly continuing to do their jobs.
Over 20 years of an American and Western presence that enabled a vibrant media landscape in Afghanistan, the Taliban and other Islamists often targeted journalists in suicide attacks and bombings. Yet today, the Taliban have officially declared the media free and independent to work, unlike when they last ruled Afghanistan from 1996 to 2001. Still, Afghan journalists are reeling from beatings, detentions, and ever-tighter Taliban restrictions on what can be reported that raise questions about the future of free expression in Afghanistan. Saad Mohseni, head of the Mobi Media Group, which includes the 24-hour Tolo news channel, says, "Anyone who says we are not doing our job is obviously not watching our TV stations and programs. But for how long, I'm not sure," says Mr. Mohseni, contacted in London. Tolo News notes that 153 local media organizations have shut down across Afghanistan in the past month. Mr. Mohseni says, "I don't want to get too optimistic because I know things can change quickly. And I don't want to be too pessimistic because so far the Taliban have given us enough freedom for us to be able to continue with our work." He says, "It's not even a day-to-day proposition. It's an hour-by-hour proposition." This story was reported by Scott Peterson in London for The Monitor.
Canadians have watched concernedly as political polarization has divided the United States. But centrism appears to be winning the day in Canada's national elections.
For many Canadians, the campaign ahead of the snap elections on September 20th has been full of partisan spite, perhaps never more clearly than when a member of the right-wing People's Party of Canada threw gravel at Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the campaign trail earlier this month. But political analysts say that's not the full picture. They say this race has been one of the least contentious in recent history. As conservatives in the United States and several European countries have moved further right to capture votes, in Canada the conservatives have tracked to the center, and the mainstream parties have remained united in the country's biggest challenge, fighting the pandemic. Everybody in politics right now will tell you that the tone has become nastier and coarser, says Maxwell Cameron, a political science professor at the University of British Columbia. I think one of the things that's most interesting about this election is that it's not really a particularly polarized election across a wide range of issues. This story was reported by Sarah Miller-Yana in Toronto for The Monitor.
Why do opposition-minded Russians vote in the elections? Because despite the state's tight controls over parties and the dirty tricks of the ruling United Russia, voting can make a difference.
Russia officially declares itself to be a democracy. Russian media cover the campaigns much as the Western press covers elections. And just about everyone agrees that the elections do matter. But while 14 parties covering a wide spectrum from left to right will be competing for seats in Russia's lower house of parliament in a September 19th election, opposition parties are carefully managed by the Russian state. The gamut of loyal opposition parties is genuine, and much of the criticism expressed by them can be as biting as in any Western democracy. But via electoral controls, individual pressure on candidates, or political dirty tricks, the state keeps any party or candidate who becomes a significant threat to the ruling United Russia Party from success at the polls. Still, opposition candidates believe running is worthwhile. Little by little, even small drops of water can wear down a stone, says Oleg Mandrykin, a candidate for the Liberal Yabloko Party. We do not need any more revolutions in this country. That leaves us only with gradual, democratic methods to bring about the changes we need. And we've seen some small local victories that suggest it can happen. This story was reported by Fred Ware in Arkhangelsk, Russia, for The Monitor.
During economic hard times, one role that government can play is shock absorber. New Census Bureau data show the difference that Congress's quick assistance for millions of Americans made in 2020.
When the coronavirus pandemic shuttered much of the economy in the spring of 2020, about 1 in 7 U.S. workers abruptly lost their jobs. That's more than twice the scale of job losses seen during the Great Recession of 2007 to 2009. Help was needed and fast. As Congress was moving to pass relief legislation, Melissa Kearney and Luke Pardue, University of Maryland economists, researched the difference that cash payments could make for affected households. They found that average workers in the hard-hit leisure and hospitality sector, for instance, were earning just $20,000 a year, owed about $1,000 in monthly rent, and often had children to support. Federal actions at the time included stimulus checks and expanded unemployment insurance, and this week the U.S. Census Bureau released data on the resulting boost. There was still hardship, as the aid didn't always get quickly to those who needed it most. But in all, more than 17 million Americans avoided poverty thanks to pandemic relief programs, in addition to more than 30 million who were already lifted above the poverty line by existing federal programs like Social Security. The federal aid came at a cost, adding to national debt. But conservative economic analyst Scott Winship summed up the outcome this way in a tweet this week. The CARES Act and other extraordinary policy measures from last spring worked. This story was reported by Mark Trumbull for The Monitor.
How relevant is the work of Jane Austen to a society making its way through a pandemic and a racial reckoning? With more stage and screen versions of Persuasion emerging, an essayist considers the intersection of Regency times and ours.
In a first-person essay, correspondent Janet Saidi writes, Jane Austen's Regency world is not a bad place to escape to in a time of crisis, as I learned last year. Because under all the romance and bucolic country walks, characters are bearing up after insults and injury brought on by class, gender, displacement, and loss. No Austen hero exemplifies this quiet endurance more than the persevering Anne Elliot from Persuasion. This most soulful of Austen's stories is reigniting, with two film adaptations due next year and an off-Broadway adaptation from Bedlam Theatre Company, currently in previews, scheduled to run through the end of October. My literary journey led not only to conversations about Austen's six iconic novels, but also to an entire network of readers and thinkers, including those reflecting on the racial reckoning sparked by the killing of George Floyd. What becomes clear is that Austen is for everyone and can help us through the times we're in. Damianne Scott, an adjunct English instructor who was writing a Persuasion adaptation set in a modern black megachurch, says, Even if I'm reading it in 2021, these are my people. This is what's going on in my life, in my world, too. And she's speaking to me. You can find Janet Saidi's full essay in today's issue.
Now, commentary from the Monitor's editorial board on curbing climate migration. Extreme weather events, many of which are rooted in climate change, could displace some 216 million people within their own countries by 2050, finds a new study from the World Bank. And that is only in poorer countries. Added to the tens of millions of people who have fled war or political strife, as witnessed in Afghanistan, solutions to forced migration are more urgent than ever. The report notes that planners could identify places most likely to be hit hardest by climate change and help the more climate-resilient areas nearby prepare to take in migrants. Many other ways to help ease climate migration are available. More drought-resistant crops, for example, are being developed that could keep farmers home. Rooftop water harvesting can be used to irrigate fields. In some villages in India, where water harvesting and other water conservation methods are being undertaken, climate migration has been reversed and migrants are returning to their homes. Ways to mitigate climate migration are becoming well known, even as nations try to curb carbon emissions. They can also put measures in place to solve the rising displacement of people by weather disasters. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thank you for joining us. Please come again Monday when The Monitor's Lenora Chu explores how Chancellor Angela Merkel changed Germany and the world after 16 years in office. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares that whether the fires we're faced with are literal or figurative, we can turn to God for inspiration that guides us safely through, no matter our age or location. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Noel Flatt, Tori Silver, and Pavithra Rajesh.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.